Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So maybe you're listening to us while you're having a midday cup of joe, or maybe you're already on your fifth cup of coffee. You may think differently about that daily ritual after hearing from our next guest. Don't worry, no one wants to take this away from you. That would be cruel at this point. It's just a chance to learn a bit about the history of something that's so integral to our lives. Coffeeland, one man's dark empire in the making of our favorite drug, covers a centuries-long history of coffee, from its first commercial cultivation in Yemen 300 years ago to its journey to American grocery shelves. The author writes, "The history of coffee runs through the middle of this larger story about global connection and transformation." He goes on to pose this question, "What does it mean to be connected to faraway people and places through everyday things?" The book not only explores how coffee came to have such a strong effect on our day-to-day lives, but also its darker history of exploitation. And of course, there's some greed involved there. Coffeeland is written by Augustine Sedgwick, professor of history at the City University of New York. It is released on August 7th. That's tomorrow. Augustine is here with us today. Welcome to All of It.
Thank you very much for having me. It's my pleasure. It was a great idea to start the show with a meditation, too. I like it.
Yeah, we're going to try it every day this week. I think this may come and become a regular thing.
I think it's
so
great.
Coffee is native to Ethiopia. Can you walk us through, as you do in the book, the two or three, I mean, say four actually, sort of four important moments that led to its global spread, how it went from one culture to another?
Sure. Yeah, for the it's native to Ethiopia, as you mentioned, but really the first group to use the beverage form were Sufi monks in Yemen. And they used it because they were dedicated to their practice of worship, and they would spend overnight hours praying, and they used coffee to fuel that. It became, although there was some early suspicion, it became very widespread across the Ottoman Empire, and was encountered with a combination of curiosity and confusion and even disgust by Europeans who traveled in the Ottoman Empire in the 17th century. It was actually, though it was an object of suspicion and disgust, it was actually adopted very quickly in London, especially in the 17th century, where it was, from the very earliest days, used in part to keep working people sober rather than, ale and beer, which people drank all day long, tended to make clerks and apprentices rather unmanageable and unproductive. Coffee kept them alert and made them better employees. That's not to say that there was agreement about the effects of coffee in Europe when it was first introduced there, because some women in London, at the very same time as employers were celebrating it, some women said that, well, it actually made their men lazy and impotent. So Europeans did not exactly agree. But really the breakthrough for coffee drinking and kind of the clarification of the confusion around that practice came in the middle of the 19th century with the redefinition of the human body as a type of machine, as an engine. And that made coffee seem like something that was essential for the basic functioning of the body, its basic ability to do work, even though, of course, coffee doesn't provide any calories or food energy to the human system. It made coffee look like a kind of miracle drug that you could use when you had no more energy for work. When all else failed, there was coffee.
And yeah, it was thought to have medicinal properties,
right?
But people disagreed about them.
Right. Yes, in that's right. In the 17th century, and for more than a millennium before that, the idea of the body was based on the balance of humors. Mm-hmm. And foods were used as drugs to treat whatever ailed the body. If you had a, just for example, if you had a cough, then you would have something cooling and soothing. If you had, if you had a fever, you would have a cool food to help cool your body down. Coffee didn't fit into that system because it seemed to play more than one role at once. It was, both stimulating and therefore hot, but it was also diuretic and drying. So people couldn't really understand it within the boundaries of the traditional humoral system, and coffee along with tea was one of the foods that was most responsible for kind of replacing ultimately that concept of the body as a balance of humors with a concept of the body as an engine based on cycles of input and output.
My guest is Augustine Sedgwick. The name of his book is Coffee Land, One Man's Dark Empire and the Making of Our Favorite Drug. And you touched on this briefly, but I want to open it up a little bit. Is this idea of the link between coffee and productivity?
Yes.
Why were the sellers so adamant about pushing this link? And why did Americans become convinced of it?
Right. Well, as we mentioned, there was disagreement about that for centuries. Even into the 20th century, in the beginning of the 20th century, two men especially, John Harvey Kellogg and C.W. Post, whose names are familiar to most everyone from their favorite breakfast cereal, were ardent opponents of coffee because they blamed coffee for this, what they called an epidemic of American enervation and frailty and weakness that they attributed in part to the fact that everyone was drinking too much coffee. So in the 1920s, after World War I, Brazilian coffee growers and American coffee roasters, who had a lot at stake here, got together and they sponsored a study that was run at MIT. And that MIT study actually relied heavily on previous research that had been funded by the Coca-Cola company and concluded ultimately that coffee was a kind of miracle work drug that, though it didn't provide food energy that could be converted into work, provided something better. It was like an instant form of energy. It was like a miracle work drug that would give you the ability to do more work without making you feel full or tired after you ate or any of those kind of potential complications of having a big lunch that we're all familiar with. So coffee came to seem like the answer to that question. And after that, planters and roasters began to push this idea, well, let's stop the workday, maybe once in the morning and once in the afternoon for a coffee break.
Oh, that's so interesting. So this idea of this thing we think we just do on our own, this coffee break, was just manufactured and we were manipulated into it?
It was very much promoted by Brazilian coffee growers and American coffee roasters together, yes.
You write about a Brit named James Hill,
yeah,
who was a real leader in this the businessification of that's a real word of coffee in El Salvador.
Now.
It is now. tell us about James Hill.
He's in some ways the central character for the book. He was born in the slums of 19th century Manchester, England, and most people who were born in the slums of Manchester, England in the 19th century did not have great prospects. Pretty much the best thing they could do was get out and go into the world and sell the things that Manchester made, especially textiles. And that's what James Hill did as an 18-year-old. He went to Central America as a textile salesman and ended up marrying into a family that had land and coffee plantations. And it was Hill's extraordinary contribution and to basically turn El Salvador into a kind of coffee Manchester. He developed coffee plantations that operated on the same principle as Manchester's factories and founded one of not only the most successful coffee families in El Salvador, but also in the world, a family that's still very, very prominent in the boutique coffee culture today.
My guest is Augustine Sedgwick. He's the author of Coffee Land, One Man's Dark Empire, and the Making of Our Favorite Drug. You write in the book about labor issues and violence and abuse that happened on various plantations. And of course, I mentioned greed. What's greed's role in the spread of coffee as an industry?
Yeah, that's an important question, Allison. I think the really interesting thing for me in writing this book was to be able to document through Hill's story something about the making of the world that we actually all inhabit without knowing it. You know, people have asked me, well, how could Hill be so evil, or how I didn't know coffee was had such a horrific history. It does have a horrific history in certain parts, but it also has the history of coffee is the history of the making of the economic system that we all participate in. Mm-hmm. What Hill did in El Salvador was to put into place in the form of plantations the principles according to which the Manchester's factories also ran. In Manchester, if you wanted to eat, you had to work. Hill made the same thing true in El Salvador. And the truth is, the same thing applies to us in our capitalist system today. If we want to work, most of us have to eat. And if we consider that to be evil or greedy, perhaps it is. And perhaps a lot of things should change.
What impact did coffee have on politics in El Salvador and in Brazil?
A strong impact on politics in El Salvador and Brazil, especially two of the countries most dedicated to coffee in the modern era. What it did was to join the plantation-owning class with the political class. It joined the state and the plantation owners so that in both places, to a great extent in the first half of the 20th century, the purpose of the state in those places was the production of coffee. And they helped plantation owners like Hill force people to work by starving them. They helped plantation owners like Hill stand up to those people he forced to work when those people decided that they didn't want to do that anymore. And indeed, in the 1930s in El Salvador, working people organized to start a rebellion to try to overturn the order of coffee production and make their country more like what it had been before coffee, a place where people could own their own land and grow their own crops according to, you know, their own schedules and for the benefit of their own families. And the response to that uprising in the 1930s was led by the government of El Salvador, the army of El Salvador, and the coffee planters of El Salvador, and took the lives of thousands, if not tens of thousands, of Salvadorans.
As you were researching this book, what's an avenue that you wound up going down that you just really didn't anticipate?
The most important thing for me, I think, was realizing the extent to which the history of coffee is actually the history of work. And the history of work is really the history of the, especially in the modern era, is the history of the idea of energy. You know, the history of the idea that our bodies are energy-based mechanisms that consume and expend energy in the course of doing everything. And what this means is when we think of the body this way, we think of the body's most basic function as work. And that way of thinking of the body normalizes the extraordinary requirements that the modern capitalism places on us on an everyday basis. I mean, the fact that 90% of adults around the world rely on caffeine, a powerful drug, just to do what they need to do on an everyday basis, I think testifies above all to how extraordinary the requirements of our contemporary economic system are.
That's interesting. When you initially described it as this way of having workers and getting workers to have more energy to continue to work, in the last 25 years, coffee has become a luxury item in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
It's not thought of. You know, people are spending $5, $6, $7
on
a cup of coffee. From your research, why do you think that turn happened?
Brilliant marketing. I think that we have the human brain is a very, very powerful tool for allowing us to do things that don't make a lot of sense, or allowing us to make sense of things that don't make a lot of sense in other ways. People figured out how to market coffee in a different way. The interesting thing is that in part that the marketing of coffee as a is a unique and singular sense experience with this spectrum of tastes and smells that you can only appreciate if you concentrate. That comes, in fact, from the coffee trade in Central America, the first part of the 20th century. The coffee traders in San Francisco especially pioneered this way of thinking about coffee and valuing the coffee, pricing it in terms of what it tasted and smelled like, rather than in terms of what the beans looked like, which is what people in on the big coffee exchanges in the world, like New York, were doing at the time. And that way of thinking about valuing coffee in terms of its kind of flavors and aromas really originates in the story of coffee in Central America and on the west coast of the United States, and the new way of thinking about coffee as something that should be appreciated like wine also originates on the west coast of the United States with Peet's and Blue Bottle and even to some extent Starbucks, and is rooted in the history of that commerce between the U.S. and Central America.
And for somebody, last question for you, if someone wants to have coffee, wants to drink their cup of coffee today and tomorrow, and they want to do it with the lightest footprint and causing the least amount of harm to anyone, what's your advice?
Well, Alice, I think this is such an important and interesting question. We have a way of thinking about our impact on the non-human environment, the carbon footprint, which is very powerful and very useful framework for thinking about changing behaviors for the better. We don't have a metric for thinking about the impact of our behavior on people and societies around the world. And what the takeaway, the one takeaway from this book for me always has been that globalization has vastly outpaced our ability to understand it. And what I want to say most of all is that we need a new morality and language of interdependence and interconnection. I mean, now more than ever, it's clear that we need a way to talk about how to take care of each other.
The name of the book is Coffeeland, One Man's Dark Empire and the Making of Our Favorite Drug. Augustine Sedgwick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Allison.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.